And it is right now on Byline. I want to welcome you back to the program. I'm Rick Howlett. Last weekend, about 100 people turned out for a rally near the former Kentucky Kingdom Amusement Park, in which they pleaded with government officials to reopen that facility. It closed about 3 years ago when the Six Flags Company fell into bankruptcy, as you heard in that intro. That rally is where Leo Weekly's Joe Sonka began his cover story, Lost Kingdom, in which he looks at businessman Ed Hart's various proposals to reopen the property. Hart ran the amusement park from 1989 until 1997, and Joe Sonka joins us now. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
Good to have you back. Well, today at 4 o'clock is the deadline to submit proposals to, the state finance cabinet to operate the former Kentucky Kingdom. We're going to talk about Mr. Hart's proposal. He's offering a plan. Are we aware of anyone else who wants to get in on this?
We are not, and we probably will not find out for quite some time. The finance and administration cabinet says that they will not be revealing who submitted a proposal or even how many people submitted a proposal. So the only one that we know of is Ed Hart, and he says that he's going to release his entire proposal online Monday for the entire public to see. But as far as anyone else, we just don't know and probably won't for a while.
Now, Ed Hart's plan to reopen the park has had has come in several different forms, several incarnations. Originally called for a sizable state financial commitment, but he since turned to some private loans to get the park going.
Yeah, he went to private loans last year. It would be about $30 million in private loans, and then he was asking for the state to kick in $20 million after that. So he went through the process of applying for tourism tax incentives through the state, in which they would give a rebate of sales taxes up to 25% of the actual production costs of getting Kentucky Kingdom back up and running, and that's where the problems with the states and the roadblocks started to happen last year.
And originally he was asking, well, $40, $50 million in state bonds, and no action was ever taken on it.
Yeah, no action was taken on that. The legislature passed on that, and there was also an attempt to get the metro government to kick in about $17 million of bonds, and those negotiations broke down last spring.
Now, you went back and looked through some correspondence for your piece related to Hart's early proposals, and there's some evidence that he was required to jump through some more bureaucratic hoops, I guess you would say, than others who had submitted similar proposals, including the Cook family from Holiday World in Indiana, which struck an agreement to run the park and then backed out.
Yeah, what basically happened was Hart found himself in a catch-22 in trying to get a lease with the Fair Board and also tax incentives through the tourism cabinet. And basically, Hart could not get the leasing with the Fair Board, a long-term lease, because he couldn't secure the tax incentives. And he couldn't secure the tax incentives because he couldn't get a long-term lease with the Fair Board, even though both the Fair Board is also under the tourism cabinet. They could never get that agreement to go through. And part of the reason that he couldn't get the tourism, the tax rebates, it was an evolving process over that summer. But eventually they said, you don't have a lease, you cannot get the incentives.
So there appears to be some underlying, I don't know, rancor is the right word or not, between Ed Hart and the Beshear administration over this whole business.
Yeah, well, that's the big question, whether if the Beshear administration really is looking out for taxpayers and thinks that the Hart deal is not going to be good for the state, or if there's something personal here, or if the state wants to use the property for another purpose that they're not revealing. That's really the big mystery, and it's up to speculation at this point. What exactly are the differences between the Beshear administration and Ed Hart?
Ed Hart, over the past couple of years, has had press conferences. He's been on this program,
right,
and I think that's probably irritated the administration as well.
Yeah, he's been vocally, whenever he feels that he's at a roadblock, I think he did it when he was dealing with the city, too. He had a press conference and said, we need to get this going or we're not going to get the park open and we're continuing to lose money. In the depositions that I talked about in the story this week, the tourism cabinet secretary, Marquetta Sparrow, admitted that she was frustrated and disappointed by Hart stepping forward and doing that press conference in late September. In fact, the next day is when they wrote Ed Hart and basically sprung two new things on him, saying that you have to have these two things or else you're not going to get tax incentives, at which point the negotiations really broke down And by the end of September, the negotiations were called off by the Fair Board.
We're talking with Joe Sokka from Leo Weekly, who's written a cover story about the latest effort to reopen the Kentucky Kingdom Amusement Park. So now the proposals are due 4 o'clock today. Is there any timetable as to when a decision would be made on these?
There doesn't appear to be a timetable. The Finance and Administration Cabinet really isn't saying a great deal at this time. So if they get their way, then the public really isn't going to know who has submitted applications and what their details are, besides the one that Hart is putting online Monday.
And depending on the timing of this, it would probably be unreasonable to predict that the park could be open in the summer of 2013. But
well, definitely next year, it seems very doubtful. Mm-hmm. If there is an operator chosen, it would probably be 2014 at the earliest.
So you attended this rally last weekend that was held outside the Kentucky Kingdom. Who was there?
These were former employees of Kentucky Kingdom, either Six Flags, whichever incarnation it has, and they just were frustrated at the process of not getting the park open and it being dormant for 3 years. Councilman Dan Johnson was also there, and he directly called out Steve Beshear of playing politics with the park. So these were a lot of people who were upset that the park has remained vacant, and they feel that the state needs to step up and get it open.
And the park was run very successfully under Ed Hardy, sold it to Six Flags. How many jobs are we talking about there, both permanent and temporary jobs, summer jobs?
Well, based on Hart's new plan to invest $40 million, that would be a pretty significant reopening of the park. So we could have roughly 1,000 jobs created by this, not to mention the revenue that could come into both the state government, local government, and the Kentucky State Fair Board, which has been hemorrhaging money over recent years. They're over $5 million in the red. So this is income that can come to the state through sales taxes, through rent, through parking. So there's a lot of money that's being lost by the park being vacant. Right now, it's just a question of whether the state wants to go through opening the park again, or whether they want to use it for another purpose that they think would be better.
And again, one thing we do know is Ed Hart is going to release the entire text of his proposal on Monday.
Yes, he will release the entire thing Monday. One of the big issues that Beshear administration has with the announcement that the park first had this August, the Hart first had this August, was that one of the $30 million bank loans that he's using to develop the park privately, he wanted the state to guarantee that in case it defaults. So we'll see Monday whether Hart actually put that into the deal, or whether he doesn't have that in the deal. The Beshear administration said that was specifically a deal breaker, so we'll have to wait until Monday to see.
And we should point out this proposal is led by Ed Hart, but there are some other investors.
Yes, just Bruce Lunsford is one of the investors. And it's $40 million all privately funded, as opposed to his proposals from the last 2 years, in which the state was actually putting up a large portion of money.
All right. Joe Sokka's cover story, Lost Kingdom, is in this week's Leo Weekly and at leoweekly.com. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
This is Byline on WFPL, and I want to welcome now to the studio Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Kenny Colston, who is here to talk about a couple of things he's been covering. Welcome back, Kenny.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the private Medicaid operator Kentucky Spirit announced this week that it will leave the state, and this was somewhat of a shock, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the state was kind of surprised by it, even though that they've been having conversations with Kentucky Spirit over their problems. You're talking about a company that is breaking contract a full year early, and so I think there was a lot of surprise. But Kentucky Spirit has had problems since day one of this statewide managed care implementation. I mean, they've been in lawsuits with various hospitals. A lot of their members switched right at the deadline, so they didn't have a lot of members. And at the end of the day, we have to remember, for these companies, managed care is about making a profit. And at the end of the day, Kentucky Spirit said, we're losing so much money that we have to just, they're not conceding that they're going to take any penalties, but basically the decision they've made is that whatever penalties a judge throws at us would be better than the millions we're losing on a monthly basis.
And Governor Beshear said there could be a lawsuit.
Oh, there's definitely going to be a lawsuit, without a doubt. Both Governor Beshear and Cabinet for Health and Family Services Secretary Audrey Haynes said they're going to take this to court. This is a breach of contract issue to them. They very clearly stated that Kentucky Spirit does not have permission to break this contract. And you're also looking at, you know, different estimates between a $60 million and $168 million hole in the budget based on Kentucky Spirit leaving, depending on how you calculate things. And so that's also a large chunk of change in cash that the state was expecting. Obviously, revenues aren't going to be able to cover that. That's not in the rainy day fund. So they're also going to take them to court to recover that amount of money.
And this was a budget. These companies were engaged to help balance the budget under this plan proposed a couple of years ago by Governor Beshear.
That's right. This whole thing came about because Medicaid in Kentucky is clearly the largest drain on the budget. It is the biggest thing. That's well known because we're an unhealthy state for various reasons. And so they basically, in a off year in 2011, they had to reopen the budget and deal with Medicaid. And Governor Beshear's plan at the time was to basically privatize this, take it out of state government's hands, hand it over to three, well, they didn't have a certain number, but three MCOs, managed care operators, and they would do cost savings. Of course, patients and doctors have complained that cost savings basically means you're not paying the doctor for the care he's given to the patients. But that's another debate I think we've had on plenty of bylines.
Oh, yeah. Are other companies getting cold feet that we know of?
You know, actually, I think this is a better situation for the other two statewide companies. Coventry Cares and WellCare, they get more members on their rolls, which means they get more money from the state. It's two, you know, they're splitting a pie in half instead of three ways. A lot of advocates were saying that three statewide MCOs probably wasn't a viable solution. And it looks like apparently it's not in this first year. There's also some companies that say, hey, look, we're ready to get in there. Notably, Passport Health Plan here in Louisville. You know, they have three other competitors in Louisville. They no longer have an exclusive contract. And they say if they don't expand within the next 3 years, they're going to have to cut staff and everything else. So they want to expand from a business sense as well. Passport's looking to get out there. And Secretary Haynes even said that Humana, which is getting into Medicaid here in the Louisville region for the first time, as we speak, has also expressed to her that they might want to expand statewide. So while there will be issues with Kentucky Spirit, with them leaving, with some Medicaid budget issues and everything else, it appears in a couple years there will be plenty of companies that want to step into the void that they've created.
Moving on to another topic, let's talk for a moment about Kentucky Senate President David Williams. There's been talk that Governor Beshear, Williams has been a thorn in Beshear's side, to say the least, for a number of years. But there is a judgeship that would be open that the governor could appoint him to. Williams is apparently open to the possibility of accepting that. And now some lawmakers are calling on Williams, if he does accept it, to do it in a way that will not put more of a drain on the pension system.
That's right. You've got five GOP House candidates in very competitive races. We're talking about five people who could be lawmakers come January. They've basically kind of banded together. They're kind of Tea Party candidates. And what they're asking Williams to do is, if he's selected for the judgeship and if he accepts it, instead of resigning his seat to take this job, as if he was just moving from one job in government to the other, they're asking him to retire from the General Assembly. Because what happens is there's a loophole in the pension system that was a part of a bill in 2005. And if he resigns and moves, basically, if he stays 3 years in this judgeship, his pension will be in almost double than what it is now. I mean, state senate president makes, I think, somewhere between $50,000 or $60,000 a year. Pension system is defined by your top three earning years. But as a judge, he would make over $100,000. At the same time, if he does retire, he'll still be able to double dip two pensions, but that would be considerably smaller because he won't have all his legislative time counting at that higher salary.
Now, this wouldn't put a big strain on the pension system. I don't want to make it sound like it's going to make it or break it, but it would be setting a good example, I guess, according to these lawmakers.
That's exactly what they're saying, because basically Williams has been on record saying he wants that 05 loophole kind of repealed. When he was running for governor, he said he would basically donate the difference if he was elected governor in salary to the Treasury on his own will. So they're basically trying to hold his feet to the fire and make sure he still has this thought. That being said, yes, this is just one person. The pension system is in a big crisis, and the legislative nor judicial pensions are some of the systems that are in crisis. But they want basically David Williams to take a stand, to basically say, hey, I'm going to take the first step.
Just a couple of seconds left. We haven't heard whether or not he's going to follow their advice, right?
No, actually, the nominating commission meets next Thursday, and I would suspect maybe on the next byline a week from now, we might know.
All right, we'll talk about it then. Kenny Colston, Kentucky Public Radio, Frankfort Bureau Chief, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. And back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Hallett. We're going to turn our attention now to sports, and joining us is WDRB's Eric Crawford. Welcome back, Eric.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Good to have you here. Well, let's start with some college basketball. Seems to be a lot of excitement surrounding that. Season's set to begin soon. The practices are now going full bore. There have been some exhibition games, not exhibition games, but scrimmages, I'm trying to say. The Kentucky Wildcats are the defending national champions, of course, but if early polls are to be believed, they're not the top team in the country heading into the new season, or even the top team in this region. That would be Indiana.
Indiana is number one. The USA Today coaches poll just came out this week. Louisville is number two, and Kentucky is number three. And what that basically means is we're just picking up where we left off last fall. Yeah. It's going to be that big a deal. And those teams, surprisingly, have never been in the top five at the same time in the Associated Press poll, as long as it's been taken back into the 1960s.
Really?
So it's an unprecedented time here.
Well, let's start with Indiana. Of course, Tom Crean arrived in, 2008 from Marquette, had to rebuild a program that had been through an NCAA scandal, and he's got him at the top of the game now.
He has pretty much the consensus National Player of the Year in Cody Zeller at center, and he's got a talented group that went to the Elite Eight, would have been a Final Four team last year if they hadn't run into Kentucky. They have the experience, they have the talent, they're offensively a wonderful basketball team. Just need to kind of put it together on the defensive end, but everybody expects them to, and more people have picked them number one than anybody else.
And as you mentioned, U of L second in many polls. Rick Pitino returning many players from his Final Four team last year, including, of course, Peyton Siva, the All-American candidate.
They probably have less future NBA representation than the other teams, but they have more what's believed to be chemistry, and they have a lot of depth. Some guys who were hurt last year are now coming back. Wayne Blackshear, a lot of people expected a lot from him last year, and he was hurt. So they're very promising and have the best point guard, one of the best in the country, in Peyton Siva.
You know, one injury that's unfortunate. I was at the game last year where Mike Mara tore his ACL, and he did it again. He was recovering. He did it again this year in practice, and he's decided not to pursue basketball.
Yeah, it looks like he's going to go on a coaching track, and it's a shame. He's a great kid, and I don't know if he would have played a lot this year with as deep and talented this team is, but he had a great understanding of what Rick Pitino wanted to do with the offense, and they're going to miss that because he could get on the court and get people organized.
Well, UK lost its starters to the NBA draft, but John Calipari's back this year with a new crop of young talent, including the highly prized recruit Nerlens Noel. Now, there was some question about his eligibility going in just here in the recent weeks, but the NCAA now says he's been cleared to play. Right?
He's cleared to play. They were looking at some associations he and his family had when he was in high school. He was receiving some benefits here and there, but they've cleared up any questions over that. Nerlens Noel is great. He's not an Anthony Davis. He's not that good, but he's very good. They've got another big man, a Willie Cauley-Stein. Kentucky could have two 6'10 kids on the court at the same time, two great kind of swing players in Alex Poitras and Archie Goodwin. And they've got a point guard who sat out and redshirted last season who's going to play. They're very talented. From an NBA professional standpoint, they're the most talented of the three teams.
Do you think they're deserving of the number three ranking?
Yeah, I think they are, and I think you'll see them spend time at number one sometime this season. I think you'll just see the teams go back and forth a little bit. But the fun thing for us is that when Kentucky plays Louisville on December 29th, it may be the best regular season basketball game of the year.
I took my son to a father-son camp up in UK back in June, and there were 900 other campers there.
Intimate setting.
Yeah, but the young man he just mentioned who transferred from, and he sat out, I can't think of his name. He was there. They kind of scrimmaged a little bit while we were there. I can't think of his name. But anyway, he could really fly.
Ryan Harrell, I think is who
you're
talking
about. Ryan Harrell. He was really something else. I think fans are really going to be excited to see him play. Now, UK and IU will not play this season, right?
No, and that's a shame. They were scheduled. IU, had they gone on their regular rotation, would be coming to Rupp Arena this year, but John Calipari would not sign a contract that in that involved his team going back to Bloomington to play. Yeah. So they're not going to play for a year or two. But the interesting thing is that Indiana and Louisville may start up a series here soon. So that'll be good.
We're talking with Eric Crawford here on Byline on WFPL. Well, let's turn to football. U of L now officially bowl eligible. Still undefeated at 6-0 following the win last weekend at Pittsburgh. Back in action tomorrow against South Florida after being out on a road trip for about a month, I guess, plus they had a week off. Now, some would argue that the Cards' schedule hasn't been all that tough, but they still have some pretty tough opponents coming up, Cincinnati and Rutgers, right?
Yeah, it hasn't been, but you're right. Rutgers has been better than expected. In fact, the first BCS national poll came out this week, and Rutgers was ranked a slot ahead of Louisville. So they're a very good football team, really good defensively, whereas Louisville is really good offensively. And Cincinnati, again, will be a dangerous team because they're a really good offensive team. So that actually will help Louisville. Having a couple teams ranked in the Big East will kind of help them from a reputation standpoint if they can manage to win the games.
Yeah. Cincinnati's quarterback has to be added to the all-name team, by the way, Munchie Legault.
Munchie, and he's good. They just keep turning out good quarterbacks and good receivers at Cincinnati, and they really have – they're a program that flies under the radar. They went to a couple of BCS games, but you have to have a lot of respect for what they're doing because they lose coaches just the way Louisville's lost coaches, and they always seem to hire good people.
Now, U of L's in the top 20 in the two major polls, the AP and the coaches poll, but they're 16th, as you reported, in the BCS ranking. What does that mean?
The BCS is the one that matters in terms of getting to one of the marquee bowls if you don't win your conference. And we're talking about a system that's only going to be around this year and next year, and then will go away when the new football playoff comes. But you want to be as highly ranked as you can be, and it will come into play next year because Louisville really thinks they've got a great team. Everybody's back next year. They think they could be a championship, national championship type of team. But you've got to get up there in that ranking, in that BCS ranking. You need to be probably top 10 to start the season.
It's early, but any projections at this point where U of L could end up? I've heard speculation in the Sugar Bowl against Georgia, possibly.
A lot goes into what's available, but in general, the Big East champ has a track to the Orange Bowl. That bowl will pick last this year, I think, because the national championship's in Miami. So you're seeing some projections. We've seen projections that they'll go to the Sugar Bowl and could face any number of opponents then. And that would be fun just to go somewhere different.
Yeah. Speaking of Georgia, they're going to be in Lexington tomorrow against Kentucky. But the talk really in Lexington has not been so much the next game, but possibly the next coach, unfortunately. Joker Phillips' team is 1-6. The Wildcats lost last week 49-7 at Arkansas, and it's a game they stopped in the third quarter because of lightning. Any other possible wins on UK's radar this season?
Well, they play a team in Samford that comes in. They should beat, although that's a team that's 5-2, I think. They haven't lost many games. Kentucky has some good young talent, but it's really asking a lot for them to go on the road in the Southeastern Conference or even play at home against a team like Georgia, which is one of the top 10 teams in the country. Yeah. And they just keep getting hammered by this high level of competition. You're right. It's almost a foregone conclusion that we're going to be talking about who the next coach is going to be. The hammer hasn't dropped yet, but it doesn't figure to be too far away. But they do have some good young talent. They have some people they can build around. It's just a lot's being asked of them right now.
Your colleague Rick Bozich sought the counsel of Howard Schnellenberger, who's familiar with UK, of course, as an alum, and of course built U of L into national prominence. He says they need to find somebody strong to get behind and move forward.
Well, it was a fascinating column that Rick had, and some interesting things that Howard had to say. Yeah, Howard basically said they need somebody like him who won't take no for an answer and who will not let football take a back seat to anybody, because there are a lot of Kentucky fans who are, kind of upset that they feel like the football funding isn't what it should be, that a school like Mississippi State that has half Kentucky's athletic budget spends more than Kentucky does on football. And Kentucky's done very well developing this broad-based program with a great higher number of sports than anybody in the Southeastern Conference. But at some point, fans want to see football rewarded for a lot of what it brings in, and that's a discussion going on there right now.
Just a few seconds left. Talk about Western Kentucky real quick. They've really emerged as a good team this year.
They really have, and I'll be going down there. They have a huge game this weekend against Louisiana Monroe. It's the first time two teams from the Sun Belt Conference have met where both were receiving votes in the top 25 polls. Western has won 12 of their last 14 games. And one of the guys from Las Vegas mentioned today, if you'd put $100 down on them 15 games ago, they've covered the spread 15 straight games. If you'd put that $100 down and let it ride, you'd have $1.6 million right now.
Oh,
so
wow.
Western is money.
Go Hilltoppers. All right. Eric Crawford, WDRB and WDRB.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
This is Byline on WFPL. Carl Melantis served as a Marine in the Vietnam War and was awarded the Navy Cross, the Bronze Star, and two Purple Hearts. Since then, he's become a prominent writer through the publication of his first novel, Matterhorn, which is based in Vietnam. Most recently, he's published a nonfiction book called What It's Like to Go to War, where he examines the internal life of a soldier. Melantis is speaking tonight at Carmichael's Bookstore, 7 o'clock. He spoke with WFPO's Jonathan Bastian about his new book.
If you think one step further about killing, it is really something that only the gods or God should do. And yet we ask 19-year-olds to do it as a matter of routine. And in fact, they are raised in a culture where thou shalt not kill is a Judeo-Christian, you know, major ethic. And suddenly now it's okay. And so what used to be the case is that you would leave normal life, and then you would go into this area where you suddenly are asked to take on a role that really no human should have to be asked to take on. And compound that with, you know, a 19-year-old's brain hasn't even developed yet. It's a profound experience. And so you enter into what I'd call a sacred space. And if you were cognizant of it, if you recognize what you were doing, it would help a lot when you came back to the healing, as opposed to being just baffled. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, you go into an experience like, St. John of the Cross, you know, Dark Night of the Soul, and then he comes back from the mountain and you say, now you can have a job at McDonald's flipping burgers. I mean, it's like, this is not going to be very easy. Yeah. And so I got onto that. And the other thing that is important is that that space is being blurred. I mean, World War II, my father went on a troop ship. It took him, you know, a month to get back. We did it on airplanes. Today, you can be in a firefight and, you know, Skype with your girlfriend right afterwards. And then we've got people piloting drones who are just commuting to work with all the other commuters and come home and take their kid to a soccer game. And I think that our culture needs to catch up with our technology because we're still killing people. And, politics aside, whether you think it's a good idea or not, these people have to deal with this fact. And we don't tend to want to think of it in terms of spiritual, religious terms, because we're focused on the psychological and, of course, the body injuries. But there is a wound to the soul if you take a human life.
Yeah. You talk about this idea that one thing that might help is to have some form of a guide. You say that there's a great quote you have, which is that the Marines...
They taught me how to do it, but didn't tell me how to feel about it.
Yeah, they taught you how to kill, but not how to deal with the killing.
With the killing, that's right.
I thought that was such an interesting quote. So how do you suppose that one can prepare to kill?
Well, yeah, it's a difficult thing because, first of all, ideal Marines are very young. They're 19, 18. I mean, we're talking about endurance athletes here, all right? So these are young men. And what they want to do is beer, sex, rock and roll. They don't want to listen to philosophy. They don't want to hear anything you've got to say. So the first problem is you're going to have to set it up so that they heard it. They probably ignored it. But maybe 10 years down the road, they'll go, oh, that's what that guy was talking about. That could save them 10 years of hardship and pain. There's other things that can be done. For example, Navy corpsmen in the Marine Corps serve the same function as Army medics. Well, they're older, because they have to go through more training to get the medical background. And so they're kind of like big brothers to the Marines. 2 weeks of psychological first aid training would go a long way, so that if there was a firefight, that you immediately got someone to talk about it, but not to some psychologist. To talk to somebody who was there with you, but who actually had some training about, here's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get these people to come back from a different world, a different mindset, and get settled and centered again. That would be very easy. But that kind of mental health, our culture isn't there yet. And so our military isn't there yet.
Carl Melantis is the author of What It's Like to Go to War. He'll speak tonight at Carmichael's Bookstore at 7 o'clock. More information is available at carmichaelsbookstore.com and at our website, wfpl.org. You're listening to Byline on WFPL. Okay, we want to welcome everyone back to Byline on WFPL, and it is time for our arts segment, and joining us is WFPL's Aaron Keene. Hi, Aaron, welcome back.
Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great. Fantastic.
Well, an exciting weekend here in Louisville for ballet, as the Dance Theater of Harlem's Touring Company is back after an 8-year hiatus, and its first stop, the Kentucky Center.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I spoke with the artistic director, Virginia Johnson, this week, and I said, so why is the Dance Theater of Harlem kicking off its first national tour in 8 years? The professional company has been on hiatus while the educational companies continue to go, just because of post-9/11 financial struggles happened to a lot of arts organizations. I said, why are you kicking off here in Kentucky and not at the Lincoln Center? Hello? And she said, you know, that the Dance Theater of Harlem was really excited to partner with Louisville on this first stop of their tour, which is going to take them all across the country, crisscrossing for the next year, because of one of the things that really impressed them was how well integrated arts and arts education were in our community. So because while they're here, the members of the professional company are also leading master classes in, I think, 5 JCPS schools, movement classes as well as working with the Kentucky Center's Arts Reach Arts Education Program also. So they're not just blowing in through town to give a performance. They're really working with the local community and in their program as well. So the first big performance is tomorrow night, Saturday evening, at the Kentucky Center. And on the bill is, among there's many classical works, but the mixed repertory bill also includes a piece that it's a world premiere. And it's called Return, and it's a ballet, so it's classical dance, but it's backed by like Aretha Franklin and James Brown. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have that mix of classic and contemporary, and it's going to include some of the young ballet dancers from the Louisville Ballet School. Now, this is an amazing opportunity for these kids who are training here with the Louisville Ballet to come in a few days ahead of time. It's a whirlwind wham-bam rehearsal, but they're going to be performing on stage with some of the most exciting, best ballet dancers in the country. And the Dance Theater of Harlem is a significant institution because they are dedicated to racial diversity in ballet. And when I spoke with the artistic director, with Virginia Johnson, I asked her about, you know, what's been the national impact of the Dance Theater of Harlem being on hiatus for the past 8 years.
There is the whole idea of diversity in ballet is a question that continues to come up, and I think that there is a generation of dancers who that were missed because there was no Dance Theater of Harlem for 8 years. When I went to audition for this company, for this new company, we did a national tour, and I was a little disappointed because whereas I saw some dancers, I did not see that level of excellence that I was actually looking for. And I feel like during the 8 years that Dance Theater of Harlem was not on the stage, that there were dancers who may have aspired to be a ballerina or a premier dancer, but who were not encouraged where they were training because there was no place that they traditionally thought they would be able to go. So they might have gotten shunted off into modern dance or just shunted off into another career entirely. The presence of Dance Theater of Harlem on the scene actually created the idea in a generation of young people that, oh yes, I can do this. And without us out there performing on the stages, I think that we lost some people.
I think it really does speak to the necessity of visible mentorship.
Yes.
Being able to see yourself reflected in the highest echelons of any art form, I think, does give young people the permission to be aspirational about what they're doing. And
absolutely.
Say that could be me as well.
Yes, yes. You know, that happened to me. When I was growing up in Washington, I studied ballet. I was a kid, you know. I just fell in love with it and just had to do it. And I didn't really notice that I didn't look like everybody else in the classroom because I was so maniacal about doing this. But I remember very much sitting in the audience and seeing a performance by Martha Graham, the Martha Graham Company, and Mary Hinkson came on the stage. And I had a physical sensation because I recognized myself and her, and I didn't realize I hadn't seen myself before. So it was a very powerful moment. So I completely agree with you. There is that need to have an example in front of you for a young person who doesn't have all the reasoning faculties going to be able to identify with.
So Dance Theater of Harlem is on up at the Kentucky Center in Whitney Hall tomorrow, Saturday evening. And this is an historic moment. So hopefully all of you dance fans out there will and get your kids together and go, too. You know, I think it's going to be a pretty amazing performance.
And Halloween is approaching, to change the subject here.
Yes.
And what a better time to stage a production of Macbeth. And that's exactly what they're doing down at the Iroquois Amphitheater.
It is a gray, drizzly, Scottish kind of day outside today. Yeah. So perfect Macbeth weather. If we were in the theater right now, I couldn't say the name of the play. It's a super theater superstition. You call it the Scottish play instead. But Savage Rose Classical Theater has a new production of Macbeth up at the Iroquois Amphitheater, but not the way you've seen the Iroquois Amphitheater before. They create what they call the Parkside Studio by closing the big stage door, and they set up a stage on the stage and audience seating as well. So it's climate controlled. So it's perfect for these winter months. And it's a great way to create a sort of new intimate space out there in the wonderful renovated facility that the Iroquois Amphitheater has. The Savage Rose production is has some interesting twists. If you've seen Macbeth before, you might not have seen it like this. There's some nudity, for example.
Oh,
Rick.
What?
Yeah, we don't often think of Macbeth as the sexy play, as a sexy Shakespeare, but it's not sexy nudity. It's very raw, grief-stricken yeah. nudity, but Lady Macbeth's famous sleepwalking scene out spot is going to be performed in the nude. There's some interesting textual reasons for that as well. Artistic director Barrett Cooper says there may be some people who find nudity on stage a taboo, but that we don't need to tell the story. But by stripping away the mask of clothing, we replace it with another of vulnerability. So Lady Macbeth, who is generally considered a not very sympathetic character, becomes very sympathetic in this treatment.
Why is it unlucky to say the title instead of that Scottish play?
Oh, there's, nobody really knows the definitive origin of this myth, but theater folk are a superstitious folk. And there's thought to be ghosts that have haunted old productions of Macbeth. It's the same reason why you don't tell somebody good luck before they go on stage. You say break a leg.
Just an old theater tradition.
Yeah.
And very quickly, just a few seconds left, but you're expanding your coverage on, especially on our website, into food and dining, right?
Absolutely. We have two of the most exciting food writers in town writing for WFPL.org now, covering the food and dining beat. Our first story is up by Ashley Clark Thompson. You might know her from the blog Ashley Eats. She's going to be covering food news and the casual dining scene. And Dana McMahon, who is a travel writer about town, is going to start doing restaurant reviews for us. So expanded coverage on WFPL.org.
WFPL Arts and Humanities reporter Erin Keene. You can hear her, of course, here on WFPL and see and hear her work and reviews and a lot more at WFPL.org. Erin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rick.
This is Byline on WFPL.